In the past 20 years, one of the common things connecting horror filmmakers of every kind has been Blackmagic Design and its cameras and DaVinci Resolve software. Since its start, Blackmagic Design has democratized filmmaking, putting high-quality tools into the hands of every storyteller. The same cameras that powered Final Destination Bloodlines are also within reach of micro-budget horror filmmakers, and for post-production, DaVinci Resolve is Hollywood and the rest of the world's most widely used platform for editing, VFX, audio, and color correction, fueling everything from studio features to fan fiction, YouTube horror channels, and podcasts. Best of all, DaVinci Resolve is free. This includes some of the best folk horror films from the past 15 years. We're talking Midsommar, we're talking Weapons, Lamb, Get Out, The Lighthouse, The Witch, all done with DaVinci Resolve. Don't want to forget Chainsaw Award 2025 winners Substance, Longlegs, and Screamboat Willie. They use DaVinci Resolve, while the actual rewards being shot by Blackmagic cameras as well. If you want to learn more, go to blackmagicdesign.com. And Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and is delivered right to your door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine. So if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com to sign up. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a massive 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! Sarah! You guys see a dead body?
Well, sometimes, that is better.
Welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
My name is Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. It's not a great day. We can say that much. The great Rob Reiner passed away. He was sadly murdered in his home a couple of days ago now. And
along with his wife, we should add Michelle, you know.
Yeah. They were both, you know, they were both murdered in their home, and I guess their son is now arrested and in custody for the crime. It's a horrible situation. It's an end that I don't want to think about too much, but, you know, it's also kind of forcing us to kind of grapple with Rob Reiner's impact on cinema and specifically on Stephen King, because we are a Stephen King show. Of course, I'm going to put it through that lens. And I figured we should probably talk about it. And I wanted to do that with a couple of gentlemen. I'll introduce one. Brez, you can introduce the other. We'll start with my good friend, Drew McQueenie. Say hello to the people, Drew.
Hi, how you doing?
So, you know, Drew, if you at all pay attention to any sort of movie stuff, you know that Drew is one of the best critical voices out there. One of my favorite critics to read, one of my favorite movie lovers. We go back a long time. He's an Ain't It Cool expat, just like I am. And he's also a talented podcaster. I suggest taking a look at or listen to his show, The Hip Pocket. I've been a guest on it and had a lot of fun. It's great to have you here, Drew. You know, you had a great little a bit on socials talking about Rob Reiner's passing and his connection specifically to Shawshank, and that just made it more than apparent that we wanted to invite you to kind of discuss Rob on this very sad episode.
Drew. Yeah. I saw that yesterday and was really struck by it, and glad you could join us today because you had some amazing thoughts to share, and as always. And well, thanks, our other guest is Nat Cassidy. He's an extraordinary author, an actor, a playwright. He does pretty much everything. He'll come repair your roof if you need that. I understand he's a talented drywall repairman. he's also the
What are
author
you committing
of
me to, Brez? Oh, no.
I thought a little levity, you know, would be appropriate. You're just such a jack of all trades. His latest novel is When the Wolf Comes Home. He's also the author of Mary and Nestlings and Rest Stop. My home base Esquire declared him one of the authors shaping horror's next golden age. He's just been acclaimed up and down by everybody who knows horror. I discovered him on the Amazing Talking Scared podcast. I know Stephen King himself is a fan. Mr. Nat Cassidy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I almost want to say it's great to be here, but because of the circumstances, I wish there were better circumstances, but it's always a treat chatting with you guys.
Well, you know, it is good to be here. No matter how somebody goes, there's a memorial, there are tributes, there are gatherings in the back room of the funeral parlor, and that's what I think this is. The four of us who are admirers of, I'm sure, of everything that Rob Reiner touched and created, his acting, his producing.
Well, let's not go too crazy here. But
yeah. I know. I even think his, you know, the movies that he himself acknowledges as failures, they're far more watchable than other people's successes. So I'm going to give him that.
North.
You know, hey. It's not without its charms, but it is a horrible day. I want to tell you guys how I came to this news. I was, you know, out with my family on Sunday, got back in the evening, and then I open up social media and I see, you know, the black and white photo of Rob Reiner with the dates at the bottom. And I'm thinking, oh no, not Rob Reiner. This is terrible news. But the death of a 78-year-old is not necessarily something that would be surprising, right? You think, oh, okay, well, he's an older guy. This is sad news, though. Then I see that his wife has died. And I think, oh, this is even worse. This is a Gene Hackman kind of situation. You guys remember when we found out that Gene and his wife, Betsy, had both died together? And immediately, even when you don't know what happened, you go, something went wrong. Something happened. And I'm thinking, is it a car crash? Is it a gas leak in the house?
Yeah.
Something like that. And then you see that they were murdered. And that, it's a horrible thing for anybody to have their life taken from them, especially in a violent way. You know, I was afraid at first it might be some political violence. Rob was very outspoken. Obviously, we all know that.
First assumption. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the new, I don't know if it's better or worse. I think it's just sort of an equal plane of bad to discover that his son, Nick, who's troubled throughout his life, who Rob was desperately trying to help, apparently, along with his wife, just trying to help this kid who's now 32. He's the one arrested, obviously, and presumed innocent until found guilty by a court of law, but the police have charged him with double homicide, and it's a horrific way. It's a horrific way for anyone to go out. But I will say, the one, if there is a bright spot to this, it's the notion that this couple were trying to help this young man, this guy, and I'm sure Rob and his wife Michelle would want mercy for him in some way. Not that he shouldn't be held responsible, but I think that this is a couple that never turned their back on this troubled person, and that I think is a testament to them. I think it's as good a place to start as any, and we can get into the happier things, the creative things he did. But how did you guys feel? How did you come to this news on Sunday?
I was in the middle of, we had a bunch of friends over Sunday night for food, movies, and hanging out, and I ran out to get the food. And while I was waiting to pick it up, I was looking at my phone, and I started to see the headlines come in. And when I got back to the house, nobody else had heard it yet. And I felt like such a monster walking in and dropping that into the middle of a party.
Did you do it as charades, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, two words, horrible story. right. The shock that landed on everybody was a real reminder that Rob Reiner is omnipresent in terms of pop culture history. Everybody had a different reason that they immediately reacted. Everybody had a different thing. My girlfriend, her favorite movie, I would argue, is The Princess Bride. And that's one of those that she carries so close to her. Same with When Harry Met Sally. Those are like foundational pieces of her. And, you know, somebody else there was an All in the Family freak from the time it first was on the air. And so it just, everybody has a different reason that they remember or love Rob Reiner. I've been working with Chris Storer for the last few years, and I haven't been able to get him on the phone yet. And I feel like it must be insane because the Bear, they just added him to the family. They just brought him in, and he was such a key part of what worked in season four. Like, that, the promise he added at the end of that season was so exciting creatively. And then you just suddenly have this gap in the family. And I think for anybody that worked with him, that's the way it's going to feel. Like, there's a piece of your family missing. You know, the Frank Darabont story that I told on Blue Sky.
Why don't you retell it? Can you summarize for the people who haven't heard it yet?
I was friends with Frank before Shawshank was set up. And it was something that he had carried around for years. King optioned him the story for sold him the book for $5,000 and told him, it's yours. You can do whatever you want with it. It's yours to control. Nobody can take it from you. And so Frank waited. Frank waited to become the writer that he felt like he needed to be to write Shawshank. And when he was finally ready, he wrote it fairly quickly. And I remember reading that first draft, and it was basically what you saw in the theater. It went through so few changes. And it was so clear that he saw that whole film in his head. So it wasn't a surprise when they took it out into the town to try to find a partner for it. Everybody responded. Everybody wanted to be part of that film. And Castle Rock got very aggressive very quickly. Rob wanted to direct the movie. Rob read it, was like, this is absolutely my next film. There's no way I'm not making this. But Frank's whole thing was, I have to direct this. This is my key. This is my way into being a filmmaker. And I know this is the story that I can tell. And so there was negotiations for probably 2-3 months where they were doing everything they could to get Frank to say, okay, I won't direct this one. They offered him a 2-picture blind deal where whatever 2 things you want to make after this, we'll do. Just let Rob make Shawshank Redemption. He wants Tom Cruise to play Andy. This, he sees it in his head. This is the movie. And when Frank finally held firm, Rob was the one who was like, fuck it, we have to have our names on this. We have to be part of this. We'll make it. Okay, you can direct it. Which is how Frank ended up with his first job. And the whole time they were in production, Frank was, you know, given nothing but support, but at a distance. He truly felt like, they're giving me all the support I need, but I feel like there's a little bit of a remove because Rob was so invested in this. At the same time, Rob decided what his next film was going to be, and it was North. And, you know, North is what North is. It is a film based on a book by a very dear friend of Rob's, Alan Zweibel. And it is a film that feels like it is full of personal choices and, you know, people being allowed a lot of leash to do whatever they want on screen. And it's not a film that works. It's an interesting film. I wouldn't call it a misfire on every level. It's just a film that doesn't cohere. And I went to the first test screening of that, and the first test screening of North was a legendary disaster, like unbelievable. Jerry Seinfeld was there because Jason Alexander and Julia Louis-Dreyfus are in the film, and 30 minutes into the movie, Jerry Seinfeld loudly stood up and went, I can't watch this. It's terrible. And left the theater. It was a disaster.
Thanks, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry. Thanks for the support, but a disaster. And a week later, Frank had to
Jerry Seinfeld, star of the Kellogg Pop-Tart movie on Netflix. Watch it.
Yes, yes. And
at your own peril.
North is better than Unfrosted, I will say that. but the next week is when he had to show Rob the first cut of Shawshank. And this was after the trades had picked up the North story. It was a public disaster. It wasn't just a private one. And so Frank was terrified. And when he showed it to him, Rob wanted to see it in a room by himself. So Frank stood in the back. Rob watched the movie. And for the entire movie, Frank just watched Rob's unmoving, unreacting back. Did nothing. It was like a stump. And he was like, I'm dead. I'm dead. This is never coming out. I'm dead. And at the end of the film, Rob stood up, walked back, tears on his face, shook Frank's hand and said, it's the best thing Castle Rock's ever had its name on. Thank you. And then left. And that was it. I think of that, and I think of graciousness on a level I am not capable of. Right. This town is driven by ego. This town is driven by people wanting their name on everything a certain way. It is not a town of generosity often. And I hear that, and to me, that is the most generous thing I've ever heard in my life. I think that is a man who understands the story's bigger than I am. We're releasing this. We're going to look great. It's a movie I'm proud of. And North was not in his head. He didn't carry that into the screening room. He didn't make it about anything else. It's rare. And I have heard nothing but stories like that from people that have worked with him over the years.
Well, it's clear from his activism, such a passionate political person, that he cared about things that were much bigger than himself. This is a guy, he had money, he had security, he didn't have to worry about anything, could have kept his mouth shut, but he spoke up about what matters to him. You know, notably, one of the things he did was he was a big advocate for repealing Prop 8, which allowed marriage equality in California.
Yeah.
You know, he's a straight guy married to a woman. Didn't affect him really, but he wanted other people to have the same freedoms he did and the same opportunities he did. And I think your story, Drew, is, yeah, I think a reason I found it so beautiful is that it really points out his character. Nat, what's your connection to Rob Reiner? Tell us about his role in your life as a storyteller.
Man, I mean, so I forget who posted this, but I've seen the sentiment reflected several times on social media, on the various feeds, that when you look at, you know, the core of the great Rob Reiner movies, it's the greatest coming-of-age movie, it's the greatest mockumentary, it's the greatest fantasy movie, it's two of the greatest Stephen King adaptations. Like, if there's a subgenre that is important to you, chances are very high that Rob Reiner has directed maybe the best movie in that subgenre. So he's just always been this presence, as you've all already said. Like, there was I heard the news. I was also way too online Sunday night. And I remember, I think it was TMZ was reporting two people, Rob and Michelle's age, were found dead at a property of Rob Reiner's. And so it was very nebulous. It was very early on in the reporting. And I remember having this feeling of like, oh my God, it's horrible. But I was like, I hope it's not them. I hope they're two other dead bodies of the same age at the same
property.
A dead
person who didn't direct The Princess Bride.
Yeah. Right. I hope it's a dead stranger.
That happens. Yeah. That happens because, you know, I think it sounds like his daughter or their daughter found them. You know, the police know who it is. They know what's up, but they've got to go through certain checks to verify things. And like, and then journalists get wind of it. And like, you're basically, you don't want to be wrong. So you say, look, this is what we know right now.
Facts on the ground.
But we want to make sure you don't want to, you know, it's, you know, somebody has a brother that looks like them and then, you know, you don't want to mix up things. So that's just the slow roll of news. Right. You know?
Well, yeah, it gets to be on somebody else's shoulders to confirm it, to, you know, and I thankfully I've only, you know, not found myself in that position often in my life, but that's what happened when Scott passed, is I became the one that everybody looked to and was just like, people were starting to hear about it. We were starting to get vague tweets and stuff about it. And they're just like, you know, somebody needs to make a mention of it. And then they all kind of, even though we were never in the same place together, it was like a scene in a movie where all eyes turned to one person.
Yes.
And they're just like, it should be you. And it's not a great position to be in, but yeah, no, that I was in the exact same thing, Nat, where I saw when friends were texting me like the news of like the two found, and then they're like, yeah, but the ages that they say are exactly the ages of Rob and his wife, so this has to be them.
The authorities also do that to be respectful to family members who, like, they want the word to spread to the closest relatives and all that before it's like announced. But
it's wild because that night, I literally pretty much simultaneously as the news was starting to break, a friend of mine in a text thread reached out and said, I hear it's his son.
Yeah.
Like that,
I think
was
people had also like posted an article saying
it was very immediate. I don't know. Have you guys ever seen Being Charlie, the film that he made about Nick?
I can't say I even heard of it until now.
So it's, he made it, I remember reviewing it, and it very much felt like a father who has gone through this process, and he co-wrote the film with Nick, and it's very much about Nick and Nick's addiction and his struggle with mental health. And it feels like wish fulfillment. It feels like a movie made by a father who is hoping desperately this is the ending that we're going to get, which is a reconciliation, and he'll deal with his issues, and he'll get the help he needs. And it was sad when it came out. You could tell it was a very personal film, and that those things weren't resolved, just talking to him about it. But it feels infinitely sadder now. As a wish that he was making. This is how I hope this goes. And it is truly the unseen film in his filmography. But anybody
Did you like it, Drew? Was it a good film?
It's not bad. It's not great, but it's not bad. It's very earnest, and it's very raw. You feel a lot of pain in it. You feel that there is a lot of stuff that's very close to the surface. And I do think anybody who's trying to understand this, that film is a part of their story together. And it is very much, I think, indicative of how much Rob wanted to help Nick and wanted to find peace for him. And I just find it heartbreaking that, you know, there's this record of just how much Rob was determined to get Nick help.
I had a very similar kind of emotional response, processing response that you did, Brez, that you said when you started talking of almost this. It almost hit me the way Robin Williams hit me, with this weird feeling of like,
yeah.
Is this going to retroactively rewrite how I experience this person's filmography with this tragedy in mind? And then I kept, like, the more I think about it, the more I kind of process it, it feels almost too sanguine to say, but it comes from a sincere place. All of his movies are united by this feeling of love and humanism and connection and hope. Even fucking Misery is a love story. Like, all of them are bound by love. And as just unspeakably horrifying and tragic as these events are, I kind of wonder if that I'm just going to feel that even more, that love that is, you know, maybe in some cases doomed or, you know, doesn't end the way you want it to end. But like that passion and that connection and that desire for a better ending, I think is in everything he's ever made, which is part of the reason why he's so uniquely great at adapting Stephen King. Like, Stephen King is such a love focused, sentimental storyteller. And it has, like, there are, I'm stealing this out of your mouth, I'm sure, Eric, because we were talking about this off mic. But like, it really is like it's Rob Reiner and Flanagan and Frank Darabont that have like really found the key to adapting Stephen King, and it is doing it through the heart of these stories.
It's heart and character, and I think that's, you know, the thing that people maybe, I think, get caught up on the plotting of King when they're adapting, where, you know, whether it's Cujo, it's like, okay, it's a set piece, it's a horror icon. But the ones that truly get King and can adapt him for the screen are the ones that can find that combination of heart and character. And you know, what I was telling you guys beforehand is, you know, it's undeniable that without Brian De Palma, Stephen King wouldn't have had the meteoric rise that he had, right? It's the combination of Carrie being a massive hit on, you know, as a soft cover, as a, you know, as a paperback, and his movie. And I think that those two kind of fed into each other, you know. And you can't, you look at Kubrick, you look at David Cronenberg, these are master filmmakers. But in my mind, I don't think that anybody fully got King on screen really until Stand By Me. And when you look at
voice, it's not just character, it's voice.
Yeah,
because Kubrick's movie is a Kubrick movie. It is his voice completely. Cronenberg's movie is chilly and weird and Canadian and Cronenberg all the way through. But truly, Stand By Me is King's voice. And it's the first time you heard it on screen where you go, oh yeah, no, that's what it feels like to read his book. That's it. That's exactly the small town Maine and the vibe of it. Yeah. it's voice, man, and voice is so hard to capture because you're not literally reading his words on screen.
Well, and you know, and there is no real formula to it because there's pieces of Stand By Me that feel Stephen King-y that aren't really pulled from the book or the novella at all. And then there's other things where if you go back in, and I challenge you, if you've never read The Body and you know Stand By Me, watch Stand By Me and then read The Body right after, you are going to be blown away by, like, you will hit full 2 or 3 page runs where there's not a word changed from any of the character dialogue. Like, the screenwriters, you know, have pulled directly from King's novella there. And so when you're talking about voice, you know, you might be tempted to go, well, okay, then just, you know, throw in all the dialogue that Stephen King writes and there you got a winner. But that's not it. You know, I mean, obviously I love Stephen King to death, but you know, you look at Lisey's story and see how well all the Booyah Moon and all the weird Stephen King shit, you know, translates. It's like, it's not always a one-to-one.
Can you imagine Stand By Me directed by Adrian Lin, who was originally going to direct it?
Insane.
Unfathomable.
Yeah.
You needed that humanist, you know, that's the other, you know, thing that I think it was you, Nat, that was talking about that, where, you know, he believes in people, and it's rare that you find King writing a fully downer ending. And sometimes that, you know, that sticks out and sometimes it doesn't. But for the most part, he believes in humanity, you know, whether that means he has to somehow figure out a way to, you know, make the hand of God come in and explode a nuke to save his story at the end. Or if it's, you know, or he, you know, or, you know, if it's like a fully earned, you know, thing, like, but it's that humanity, which is why I think when we're talking about this, we're talking about Stand By Me, we talk about Shawshank Redemption. Those are two movies and two stories that, you know, are all about the goodness and support of non-toxic male friendship, right? and it's not something you get very often. You know, there's always got to be that, like, well, there's the problematic thing. You know, I don't know. Maybe people these days would get a note saying that Chris is, you know, needs to have more flaws in him as a character. You know, Chris Chambers does. You know, but. You know, I don't know. To me, like, that rings so true. And one thing I want to mention before we move on from this is, you talked about whether or not the circumstances around Rob's death is going to impact viewings of his stuff. I don't think I'm going. Obviously, anytime in the near future, any rewatch of Misery or you know, A Few Good Men or, you know, When Harry Met Sally, Princess Bride, any of that stuff, it's going to be tinged with a little bit of bittersweetness, right? But the thing that I'm concerned about, especially due to the nature of his death, and people have already been pointing this out, I've gotten texts from multiple people already going, you know, this is exactly how Chris Chambers dies The Body and Stand By Me. He gets stabbed in the neck.
He was always the best at making peace.
And that moment at the end of Stand By Me is already something that's it pulls on the heart to watch it since River Phoenix's passing, you know, where he fades off, you know, in Gordy's left, you know, alone in the street. I've already felt that, you know, that ending has changed because of that. And, like, I can't imagine, you know, the next time I see it, that scene, it, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be able to shake the Rob Reiner part of it, too. So,
well, here, by way of reassurance, listen, yeah. Marvin Gaye was murdered by his father. Yeah. Sam Cooke was also murdered. You listen to those guys sing, and you're transported. I think the same is true of storytellers.
Right.
Yes, it's a sad ending. It's definitely something you think about. Same is true of Robin Williams. But you could watch a Robin Williams movie and still laugh. You could be moved. When you stop and think about it, yes. But as time goes on, right now it's very raw. But I think as time goes on, it'll be considered one of those tragic losses. The way we think of, like, Sal Mineo. You know, you can watch him in... Yeah, Rebel Without a Cause and still be moved by the performance and you know what happened to him, and it's tragic and it's a parallel to that character. But you know, real life is separate from fiction, but the fiction exists on its own, and it has a beauty and a life of its own, and that can't be taken away. And I wanted to share something with you guys that I have this 1991, February 1991 Cine Fantastique magazine that's all about Stephen King and his various adaptations. This is around the time Misery's coming out, so there's a ton of Misery in here. There's a lot of Rob Reiner.
You want to know something real quick before you turn to the page? Can you hold up the cover again? This is an audio podcast for most people, but the cover is this very, you know, it's a drawing of Stephen King in his, like, cool era where he's like, I'm going to take off my glasses and wear my leather jacket.
Yeah, wearing his contacts.
Yeah, he's got his contacts in, and he's, you know, he's trying, he's in that, he's probably in his, you know, what, mid-40s or something at this age. So this is like his midlife crisis. Stephen King is drawn on the cover with Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes behind him. I bid on that art. That's actually hand-painted art. That all the Cine Fantastique covers went up for auction like at 20 years ago. And that's right in my wheelhouse. I love painted art. Like, if I had the money, that's the kind of shit I wouldn't buy Ferraris. I'd buy original movie poster art. I'd buy all that stuff. That went up for auction, and I'm like, I'm a big Stephen King guy. Most people bidding on this stuff, they want Godzilla and they want the big monsters, the Freddy Kruegers and stuff. And I'm like, I'm gonna go for this. And before I even had a chance to bid on it, it was like quadruple out of my budget range. And my memory, I think Frank Darabont bought almost all of them.
Probably.
So I think at some point Darabont bought that one. So
it all comes back to Darabont,
that motherfucker.
The funny thing is, Kathy Bates is featured on the cover as Annie Wilkes, and her name is misspelled throughout with a C. Kathy with a C.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because she's
Kathy, the character from the comic strip is who was actually
future Oscar winner. But that's how unknown she was at the time.
Right.
If you think about it.
Can you also show the back real fast? Because I believe it's an ad for Death Spa.
That would be a death spa.
Yeah. Matt, good call, man.
I saw it flash by very quickly.
Yep. The thing with Kathy Bates, this is here's another great example of Rob Reiner, like, really thinking about a person. Kathy Bates was an enormously acclaimed stage actress, and she had done Night Mother. That was the thing that launched her and became, like, her calling card. And everybody who saw Night Mother was, like, one of the great performances. So they announced Night Mother as a movie, and they hired Sissy Spacek. And Kathy Bates was shattered. Like, it really fucked her up, because she was like, but the whole point of making this is that we made it a thing that people wanted to make. And why wouldn't you cast me? And she was told point blank, look at you. Like, no, you're not a movie star. You're not right for movies. Rob knew her from stage. Rob knew her from Night Mother. And Rob always had it in the back of his head that when I find the role, I'm giving Kathy Bates that role that's going to break her. And it was because he was well aware that she was a powerhouse that had gotten a raw deal. And I think it was important to him to find a place to put her. And when Misery dropped in his lap, it was one of those instant perfect things. So, man, it's a case where he had an actor that he was carrying around thinking about that had gotten a raw deal, and he was determined to get her a showcase. I love that, man. I love that that's the kind of person he was.
And he's so fucking good at casting. Like, you also look at, like, Stand By Me and you know, the other, like, jewels of his canon. And the casting is impeccable. That's a little what makes me so shocked to hear Tom Cruise as Andy Dufresne, because that doesn't feel right. But, like, all of his casting feels
right. You gotta remember, though,
so
that was right off of A Few Good Men. So I'm sure, like, they had just had that experience, and I'm sure it was like, oh, Tom, that's the guy. Yeah.
I could see it. Candy. I think he could do that. It's not, you know, we'll see. Give Tom credit. So listen, here's the part I want to read to you. Reiner recalled, and this is by Gary Wood, who wrote almost every story in this issue. This is all the journalist Gary Wood. Reiner recalled screening Stand By Me for King. Quote, I was very nervous because I wanted him to like it, said Reiner. I didn't actually watch the film with him. I showed up after it was over and ran into him. He was visibly moved. He was really almost crying. He said, listen, you can hear Steve saying this too. Listen, I've got to compose myself. I'll come back and I'll talk to you. He came back in about 15 to 20 minutes and we sat and talked. He said that this was by far the best film that had ever been made of any of his works. And he said, but that's not saying very much. And then Rob goes on, and I understood why he said that, because it's exactly why I'm sure he's frustrated by some of the films that are made out of his books, because filmmakers don't bother to look past the gore. And that goes to what you were saying, Eric, is that he talked about the heart. He aimed for the heart with these stories. And he also mentions in another section why they changed the name. And the funny thing is, if you talk to Stephen King now, and he mentions this novella, even when he's referring to the novella, he calls it Stand By Me. You know, he doesn't say the body. He's not like, you know, possessive, like, my Overlook didn't get destroyed. He calls it Stand By Me. And so Reiner explains, we actually played down King's name in the marketing because we didn't want people to have the idea that this was a bloody, gory horror movie. That's why we changed the title to Stand By Me. The body, with Stephen King, sounds like a horror movie. Hmm. And it certainly wasn't that. We didn't want to mislead the audience. And then I think it was Nat who said that, like, Misery and Stand By Me is like, it doesn't eliminate King's voice. It's like a good blend of Reiner and King. And Reiner himself said this, quote, he's talking about Misery here. I don't want to disappoint King's fans. I hope they like it. It's really a blending of Stephen King and me. It's a marriage of the two of us. It's an odd kind of marriage on the surface if you think about it, but I think it made for a pretty interesting film. And King said, he hadn't seen the film at this point, but he said, it'll make a hell of a movie if they do it right. I think Rob will. If anybody can, he can. And I think that that's true. I think even the toned down elements of Misery, and the film Misery is still an intense, fucked up experience, but he did dial it back a little bit from the book. You know, it's an axe that chops off Paul Sheldon's foot instead of just hobbling him with the sledgehammer, which is nightmarish enough. But I think the axe would have become, it would have just become too much, a little too much death spa, you know?
Right. Yeah, running over the sheriff with a fucking riding lawnmower instead.
I love that part of the book, though. By the way, like with the sort of just the bloodbath of the end is a pretty intense experience in the book. Yeah. But in the movie, you know, in the movie, movies are real in your imagination. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but like you're watching something passively happen in front of you as opposed to being in a partnership with the author and creating the imagery in your own mind. So as you're reading that in your own mind, you can picture as much or as little as you want given the text. But on screen, I think, yes, he had to sort of pull it back a little, make it a little more realistic, a little less maybe operatic.
Yeah. The hobbling is so effective. And it was Reiner's idea. It was even William Goldman wanted the axe, and like that is so testament to his vision and his insight, because
it was smart.
The hobbling is so much harder to watch. Mm-hmm. You see an axe cut a foot off, and you've seen that in a movie before. You know you're watching a horror movie, but this loving sort of hobbling of like you cannot leave me now is so much more grounded in character, and it's so much more brutal to watch.
The buildup, yeah.
When I first moved to LA, I took a class at the AFI, and it was a thing where filmmakers would come in and show you the movies early. And so in 1990s when I took this class, and it was like 8 weeks, eight different filmmakers, and like Adrian Lyne came with Jacob's Ladder, and a whole bunch of other people showed up with their movies. One of them was Rob Reiner with Misery. And when they said at the beginning of the, and they didn't tell you ahead of time what anything was going to be. So you would show up and they tell you that night, here's this filmmaker, here's Richard Donner with Radio Flyer. So when they said it's Rob Reiner and Misery, I was like, oh, okay. Well, here's the thing. I like Rob Reiner, but he's not going to nail Misery. He does soft movies. He does movies about people falling in love and stuff. And I had a chip on my shoulder. So the movie starts, and Rob Reiner is sitting next to me as the movie plays. And the whole time, I'm sitting there kind of arms crossed, like, all right, cool, fine. We get to the hobbling scene, and in my head, I have already decided he's not going to show me anything because he's Rob Reiner. So I am confident that we're about to get a cutaway to something discreet. It's going to be handled a little way. And then the bam happens. And I stood up out of my seat, went, at which point Rob Reiner looked at me and started laughing. And for the rest of the movie, anytime he looked over at me, he started laughing because I had given him exactly what he wanted, which was verification. It worked. And it was one of the most visceral reactions I've ever had to anything in a movie. I think precisely because I didn't think he had the guts to do it. And then, oh my God, does he do it?
You were the opposite of Jerry Seinfeld. That's great.
It was such an experience.
That's what we've always said about you, Drew.
What's with this hobbling?
Hey y'all, it's me again. Sorry to interrupt, but I have to tell you a little bit more about this episode's sponsor, Black Magic Design. If you've watched a horror anything in the last 20 years, and I'm talking everything from Oscar winners to short films to podcasts and fan fiction, you've probably seen horror that was created using products by Black Magic Design. And also, here at Fangoria, we use a ton of Blackmagic camera switcher and software, so if you watch any Fangoria content, you've probably seen some of Blackmagic's products at work. Blackmagic Design is all about democratizing filmmaking by putting high-quality filmmaking tools into the hands of everyone. That space needle scene from Final Destination Bloodlines? Well, one of the cameras used for that was the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K, a camera that has been used on mega-budget projects like Falcon and the Winter Soldier. They put them on the helmets of the skydivers fighting the Falcon in that epic opening scene, and Saw X. And that very same camera, which is $2,300, by the way, has been used by hundreds of indie horror filmmakers and by folks like Leanna Vamp for her channels. If you've ever messed around with cameras, you know that $2,300, while it sounds like a lot of money, is an incredibly good price for a quality camera. Blackmagic's DaVinci Resolve is even more popular with horror filmmakers and fans, editing, VFX, audio, and color correction. The most used software in Hollywood, and it is free. As I said at the top of the show, some of the best folk horror from the last 15 years has used DaVinci Resolve. We're talking Midsommar, Weapons, Get Out, The Lighthouse, The Witch, Lamb. And if you haven't seen HBO's 30 Coins, you should love it if you love demonic folklore. Resolve was used to create demonic atmospheres and helped make skin textures, wounds, and the monsters really, really pop. If you want to learn more about Blackmagic Design, go to www.blackmagicdesign.com. Thanks for sponsoring the show, and let's get back to our conversation. One of the best things about Misery, one of my favorite things, is something that's wholly Rob Reiner. Well, I guess it's not wholly Rob Reiner. I guess you can give credit to William Goldman, too. But it feels very Rob Reiner, and that's the relationship between Buster, the sheriff, and the
it's the best.
You know, and his deputy slash wife, which is never, we never, part of the greatness of King's book is that once you're in with Paul Sheldon, you never leave. Paul, you're just as trapped as Paul is, where, you know, Reiner and Goldman, they knew when you were telling this as a movie, the audience has to get the fuck out of there at some point or they're going to go crazy. So that's why you have all these cutaways to the investigation and this old small town sheriff kind of figuring shit out. Richard Farnsworth is, you know, fucking great in this part. But when I think about that, like, I think that to me, the way that the sweetness of that relationship, the way that they playfully rib each other, like, to me, I see that and I go, that's Rob Reiner. You know, that might 100% be William Goldman, but it feels like Rob Reiner to me.
But so. There's another partnership that was super important. I mean, who else would have ever gotten the Princess Bride right? That thing went through so many hands and is largely an unadaptable book. I think that book is a nightmare to think about as a film, because so much of it depends on you reading a book that's missing pieces, and it's part of the story around the book that is so compelling. I would have thought a nightmare adaptation. But Goldman and Reiner together crack that thing in such a beautiful way, and it is a real testament to how Reiner draws things out of other artists. Like, as a collaborator, I think he helps get people to their best versions of their ideas. And so I think he and Goldman together had a really wonderful thing going on. I wish it had lasted longer. I wish they had done more stuff together, because I think as Goldman got older, you know, he had incredible knowledge. He just Reiner was more in touch with the zeitgeist at the moment. And I think it was a perfect collaboration of those two. And, you know, Goldman did so much uncredited work for other Castle Rock pictures. He was around a lot. And I think, again, a real testament to Reiner's grace at capturing voice on screen.
Wasn't Hearts in Atlantis also a Castle Rock picture?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dolores Claiborne, Needful Things, Green Mile.
Once they were in the business, they were in the business. I mean, yeah. Like it was a big, you know, the idea that their company's named Castle Rock is just one of those things where it's like, it's a lovely ongoing sort of nod to the fact that it's one of those important relationships in Reiner's life.
I found an old interview with Rob that I did in 2003. And wow. We were talking about Alex and Emma, his romantic comedy. And he, at the end, I ask him, you know, hey, so any other Stephen King things in the works? And he said, oh, whenever Steve has a book, he sends it to us first and says, before I offer this out there, do you want it? And he goes, sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's not for us.
I love that.
But that's how they end up with all of those different adaptations, is Steve would go to him first because he trusted him so much with Stand By Me.
It's funny how King will grab on to certain filmmakers, like, you know, Josh Boone was that guy for a minute, and then kind of disappeared. But if you remember, for like about a 4-year period, Stephen King just decided, you're doing everything that I'm going to do. He was going to, you know, he ended up doing the Stand, or no, he didn't do The Stand, did he? He was trying to do The Stand, and then he was going, I don't remember how involved he was with the miniseries that ended, or the, yeah,
he
the
started series, it, but yeah. Then it got the two other people took over as showrunners.
Yeah, but I mean, that was Mick Garris for a huge amount of time. That was Darabont for a huge amount of time. That's Flanagan, you know, is pretty, you know, current, that guy. But I love that King finds these people to go, I just like you, so yeah. Now you get the first dibs on anything, you know? And yeah. He doesn't really vet it. He doesn't seem to think about it. Like, King goes with his gut with this stuff. I think it's also because he's a big movie guy and he loves movies, but you know, it's also not super important to him. You know, once you've
he's not precious.
Yeah.
He's not precious. It never feels like he's precious about the stuff once he lets go of it.
Well, I think he senses respect. Mm. If you're somebody who's adapting his work because you love it, the changes you make are probably going to be acceptable to him because you're not changing it to be because you think it sucks, or you know, something else. It's like because you need to make something visual or shorten something, or like you say, you need to have some escape from this room where Paul Sheldon's being held captive. And like, I think he understands you got to put your own mark on it too. But I think where he gets, and I don't want to speak for him, but I think where he gets irritated is with Kubrick. Kubrick dissed the book in public. Mm-hmm. He talked shit about the book, and he's wrong. The book is amazing, and there's a reason he wanted to adapt it. But I think the ego that Kubrick had demanded that he say, my version is superior to this pulpy thing. He had to distance himself from a book that was being sold in Kmart, you know? And he was wrong about that. He made an amazing film. I think The Shining is a fantastic adaptation. And I'm glad Steve has begun to come around on it, thanks to Mike Flanagan and maybe just the years softening it. But I think it was hard for him to accept. Well, he had to say, like, fuck me, fuck you to the movie The Shining, because Kubrick talked shit about him. You know, it made it hard for him to love that movie. And I think if Kubrick had been like, this is a fantastic book, it's a merger of the two of us, King would have said, all right. I mean, King was a younger guy then, too. I'm sure he had his own ego and his own feelings about the movie.
The whole other part of it is that up to that point, King hadn't had a failure yet, right? And the movie was a critical and box office failure. And his fucking readers hated it. Like, I urge you, you know, if you're at all interested in about this stuff, go to YouTube and look up Stephen King doing these college talks and stuff in this era. And you'll see every single there's always a point at the end. You'll hear him sell the same stories and do the same bad dad jokes and all that stuff. But every single one of them, there's an audience Q&A part. And in this era, we're talking 80, 81, 82-ish, right?
We're talking the fly collars, right? Open down to the navel, he's the got chest hair.
He's got his merkin that's popping out on his
chest hair and beard hair blending together in harmony.
But every single one of these ends with a Q&A section, and there's not a one of them where somebody goes how furious they are about what Stanley Kubrick did to this book that they love so much. And you'll see a progression of him going, ah, it's not so bad, or like, here, and he always tells the story of Kubrick calling him and asking, you know, if he believes in the God, like calling him at 3 a.m. or whatever and saying, do you believe in God? And King will go, yeah, kind of, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, maybe this and this and that. And Kubrick just will go listen to all that and go, eh. He's like, I don't think there's a God, and then hangs up the phone. You know, he'll tell that story over and over again, but you'll watch a progression of him going from like, yeah, it's a, you know, whatever, it's not, to being a little critical, to being, yeah, fuck that movie. I think that he was also pressured just by his readers. Every single time he did any kind of appearance, somebody was there to tell him how shitty The Shining was. So if you listen to his early, early stuff, like right when the movie came out, he's very protective and defensive of it. And it's not until later that, you know, that he grew as thorny about it as...
I think also when The Shining came out, there were what, 3 Stephen King movies? 4? Like it was 2? Like 2. It's so early.
I mean, there was 2 in the miniseries. It was Carrie, Salem's Lot, and The Shining, right?
So that's so early. You're still at the point where you're trying to figure out if Hollywood even has a relationship with you.
Yeah.
You know, you have the one big hit, you have the one kind of turbulent, difficult production on the miniseries, and then one of the biggest filmmakers on the planet adapts your work. It's got to be a really weird position to be in where if you genuinely didn't like it, how do you even broach that? Like, it's definitely a strange thing to have to wrestle with. He was not a brand name in that way yet. I don't know what I was just watching. I was just watching something where there was a paperback copy of Salem's Lot. Was it Wake Up Dead Man? It might have been Wake Up Dead Man because I just saw that again. But somebody has at one point on a counter a Salem's Lot paperback, and it's the paperback I had in 1979. Like, it is the same cover, the same edition.
Is this the black cover? Black
face?
Yeah, the black
cover. The black teeth with the red
embossed teardrop.
Yeah.
I get thrown back in time by those covers. Like, because I remember the sensation of going to the bookstore or finding the book on a stack of books my parents had or whatever. I devoured all those books in that form. And it's like when I see and When Harry Met Sally. And one of my favorite weird film jokes of all time is Billy Crystal reading Misery. And just having that book. It's one of those things where you're like, did you know already for sure? Did you not know? Were you just reading? Like, it's so weird. But I love that. And I love the fact that I love all the ephemera around these movies. I remember the experience of, as an usher in 1986, being in the theater, getting a tube of posters we had to put up for new movies, taking the posters out of the tube and unrolling them, and seeing the Stand By Me poster for the first time, and being hypnotized by it. Because
this
it was one?
One
of the,
is this it?
It's that the image, but it's with the quote over it. Mm-hmm. If I could have only one food for the rest of my life, I know what it would be. Pez. Cherry flavor Pez, no question about it. Just that quote, nothing else. I was like, what fucking movie is this? What is that? And I found it such an arresting design. And I feel like there's a lot of that, not just the movies themselves, but just particular things about editions of them. That poster speaks to me, man. Mm-hmm. I immediately go back in time when I see that.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
a thing about that quote, it's, too, that immediately just fires up. Like, one of the things that makes Stand By Me such a great quintessential King movie and movie in general is the hangout vibe. Like, like you were saying earlier, Drew, the voice. But it's specifically, like, just the hanging out with your friends feeling. And then you look at, like, Castle Rock producing Seinfeld and things like that. And there's an additional element to Reiner that we haven't really touched on yet, but I think is another key to why he's so uniquely adept at Stephen King, which is he's so fucking funny. And King is, for all the dad jokes, King is really fucking funny. Like,
oh, he's
I look at, as an actor, as a classically trained actor myself, I look at King's performance in Creepshow and I listen to the audiobooks that he narrates. And he's a good fucking actor. Like, I will go to bat for King as a very underrated comedic actor.
His cameo in Brown. Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, fucking Maximum Overdrive. I mean, that whole movie is hilarious.
It's a joke that he is perfectly set up and executed.
Yeah,
honey,
yeah.
Sugar buns. This machine just called me an asshole.
Oh my god, I wish I could do the main accent.
Look at this performance right there. Yeah. Very believable.
Face. Look at that face. Yeah. That is a mugging character actor, if ever there has been one. And Reiner is a fucking sitcom actor. Like, there's a sensibility to their senses of humor that also works in a way that, like, could never work with Kubrick, who I think is underrated as far as a funny filmmaker, but, like, his sense of humor is so different from Stephen King. So, of course, there's going to be that disconnect.
Well, it's also should be noted that, like, so many of the people that we were talking about, the Flanagans, I think even Darabont, you know, that's the generation, you know, after, you know, at least one generation after King, where Rob Reiner and King were of the same generation. It's why he got the nostalgia of that story, you know, and why he was able to lean into, you know, that 50s aesthetic, and you know they both had nostalgia for the same things, you know. So Pez, cherry flavored Pez. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because that line to me is one of the best summations of the way a kid thinks about the world.
Mm.
Like a kid thinks, oh yeah, I could eat cherry flavored Pez forever. No, you couldn't. But
until the scurvy.
Be like, my guest.
Yeah, it won't last long, but okay, go for it. But I love that it captures a feeling of when you're a kid and the way your brain works and the way the world seems to you. I think it is, in its own way, just as evocative of childhood as, say, Calvin and Hobbes, in terms of just really capturing the feeling of being on that the weird cusp between the adult world and the kid world, and that moment you're kind of navigating both. Take it out of the realm of adaptation. It's just one of the great films about childhood, and I do think it's that shared sense of nostalgia for the 50s. You know, growing up in the 80s, I felt like whether I liked it or not, I had a 60s flashback that was 10 years long. Mm-hmm. I got 60s culture jammed down my throat and to the point where I feel like I lived through the 60s. I feel like it because so much pop culture was about that. But that 50s thing that King does so specifically, and that one era that he just owns when he writes it, I think Reiner had such a keen memory of it too. And man, that film is impeccably production designed. The town that they shot in is frozen in that moment in time. It is one of the great evocations of nostalgia without being the cancerous version of nostalgia that we have now that is corporate and prepackaged. And this is just memory. It's just, this is all the things that I remember about being a child channeled into this story.
It's funny. It's what Stranger Things captured with the core four boys that King was doing for a generation earlier in the 50s with Stand By Me and The Body, is looking back and when I watch Stranger Things, I'm like, that's what I remember being like with my friends. It's not quite the same as the 50s, but the dynamic is the same. The aesthetics maybe are a little different. The songs, you know, but the vibe is riding your bike and hanging out in each other's wood paneled basements and
absentee parents. Yeah.
Absentee
parents.
I think
one of the reasons that the 80s and the 50s that when we saw this in the 80s as kids, clicked so hard with it is because we were still free range kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't exist now. My kids look at Stand By Me and it looks fucking insane to them. They're like, what are they doing? How are they doing that? They just leave? And their parents don't know where they are. What are you talking? Like, my kids have grown up in a helicopter culture, and it's, you know, constant parenting, and we're so involved, it's insane. And I do think that we had a similar upbringing, similar enough that when we watch Stand By Me, that freedom is something we still recognize, that we absolutely still had access to. And I think that's why it spoke so cleanly to us.
It's true, because I think it was almost like a dialing back that ended up like being sort of on the same frequency as the 50s, because in the 70s, kids were like, not only was I free range, but I was at the Sunset Strip at the Whiskey.
It got wilder.
At age 20, it's like it got wilder, and then it got a little more like, oh, you're free range, but you're like roaming around the woods near your house instead of doing blow with, you know... David Bowie.
Reagan's America was way more conservative. Reagan's America was a heart was leaning back towards that 50s vibe. So it's culturally we were in the same place, and I think that Rob was so smart about the way he folded those things together. Because Will Wheaton and River Phoenix, and those are very modern kids. Corey Feldman, very modern kid. He was very much of the 80s. But, yeah, it's a believable drop-in. You so easily drop them into the 50s, and it feels right. I would just like to say also, when we talk about the casting, Joe Dante discovered River Phoenix for Explorers. But Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix both talked about the fact that after Explorers, it was like they didn't have a film credit because Explorers was such a disaster and they didn't pop in a way that made people go, well, okay, the movie doesn't work, but those kids are so dynamic. It just wasn't that kind of a vehicle. So both of them felt like they had no careers again immediately. Ethan Hawke went back to school. Phoenix went back to Florida. They really were out of the business. I think Rob Reiner, what he saw in Phoenix was so particular and was the first director to go, okay, I see a gravitas in this kid. I see something in him that is really deep and I know I can tap it. And I think the rest of Phoenix's career leaned heavily on that impression he made on audiences in Stand By Me as that rock solid kid. And there was a maturity to him and a wisdom to him. And I immediately casting directors went fucking bananas for him because
wish I was your dad. That line is like,
God. Yeah.
Bullshit. Bull true.
Yeah. And like Feldman was already established, Will Wheaton went his direction, but Phoenix was the one that I feel like Reiner found an actor, found a real resource there, and then gave him the right showcase where the rest of Hollywood went, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, everyone in that movie, top to bottom, is just, it's career best performances from every, Jerry O'Connell, and the fact that Jerry O'Connell was able to age out of Vern and find another career outside of Vern speaks to his abilities as an actor, too.
Because Vern is perfect. Vern is...
Oh my God, he's so perfect.
He's just Vern. I love that he doesn't look like Vern at all, because in a way, it keeps Vern very special.
Yeah.
Vern is just Vern.
He's captured on cellulose.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Kiefer Sutherland is fucking as Ace. And Ace,
awesome. Yeah.
Even Richard Dreyfuss as Daniel Stern of it all.
Yeah.
It's so impeccably done. And just briefly flashing back to something you were saying earlier, Drew, about it made me think of Misery. I remember I was born in 81, so I first came to Stand By Me as like 8 or 9 year old on VHS.
Wow.
It had been out for a while. And that movie, for a number of years, evoked such a complicated push and pull of dread for me, because I loved everything with the boys, right? I saw myself and my friends in these boys. But Ray Brower scared the shit out of me, because it was so real. And it wasn't real in a horror movie way of oh my God, here's a dead body, but it was real in oh my God, a kid can die. Exactly like the movie is positioning it to be, right? It's this, it's this stark wake-up call. But when I was also that age, there was something about those moments in the movie. I would fast forward past those moments when I was a little kid, because it was captured so perfectly. And nostalgia and the power of nostalgia and how people are trying to recreate those feelings of nostalgia that this movie was evoking and kind of spearheading in a way. And the fact that he never shied away from the hard edge of the story and just fucking River Phoenix's face and the pain in River Phoenix's face and how it's that combination of material and actor and director who could convey that. That movie fucking hurts. And it's because of that love that we've all touched on already. It would be the easiest thing in the world to make that a sweet little nostalgia pick about kids. But he saw what was in the King material and he saw what was in his actors. And it's almost too potent at times.
It's where a lot of YA stuff kind of fails. These other coming of age stories fail. The reason why Stand By Me is the gold standard for that is because it has that underlying sadness and realism, right? These are all four very broken or potentially broken characters. They yeah. come from not ideal. Not a single one of them comes from a nice loving house. Even Vern, who we don't know if his parents are shitheads or not. We know his brother's a delinquent, part of Ace's gang, right? That's how they find out about all this stuff. You know, but like Gordy's the ignored child, and Teddy's dad's, you know, the loony up in Togus, you know, and burn his ear on the stove. Chris's family is full of criminals, and you know, everybody assumes he's going to be bad too. You know, there's, you know, I love that, you know, I think the thing that I always gravitate towards is that there's always that feeling of found family with that mm-hmm. group. And that's something that I'm a big believer in. You know, and it's so funny, you know, I just got married this year, and Drew was at the wedding. Anthony was at the wedding. Guess your invitation got lost in the mail, Matt. Sorry.
I had other things to do that day.
Yeah. But, you know, but what's funny is that, like, I've always been a person where my family are to me, family is who I choose, not who I'm born into, who I'm related to by blood. I have cousins that, you know, that my mom, you know, tried to get us to hang out and stuff when we were kids. I didn't give a shit about, you know, they might as well be strangers to me. But my friends, you know, they're my family. That's how it's always been. And Kelsey's family is, I wouldn't say the opposite, but they very much are, you know, her mom knows and sends Christmas cards to the eighth, you know, cousin twice removed. You know, she knows everybody, she knows all their kids, she knows who's all of their kids, all of their friends, like all that stuff. But what speaks to me about Stand By Me is, like, you know, I'm used to seeing the big family thing. I wasn't used to seeing that kind of, it's just on the surface just boys bonding, but it's that found family that, you know, they're you know, that are picking up the pieces from where the traditionally that would have been the good brother or the nice stepdad or whatever would have been that role. But the fact that they found that family and that support system and friends, that's what spoke to me as a kid. I couldn't have told you that when I was a kid. I knew I liked it, but looking back at it now, you know, that's what adds the depth to it. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get to, is that there, you know, there's a tinge of sadness to that movie, which I guess maybe to what we were talking about earlier with, you know, how the ending of that film now is always going to be doubly sad with the parallels to what happened with Rob, and the parallels with what happened to River Phoenix. You know, it doesn't, I don't know if that'll take you out of the movie, though, because that movie has that tinge of sadness to it, just like life.
Deal with those things. Like, yeah. it's not, you're not getting this accident now grafted onto it. The movie's already grappling with it.
I'm sure that there's plenty more that we could dive into. You know, we obviously didn't talk a lot about his work in, like, Spinal Tap, for instance, or, you know, any of that stuff. But
I think just acknowledging that run of the first seven films is maybe the best run of any director's first seven films ever.
Yeah.
I, you know, The Sure Thing is the one that people always leave out when they do that. Don't leave it out. The Sure Thing's awesome. The Sure Thing is a great movie. And I truly think when you look at that run of, this is Spinal Tap, The Sure Thing, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men. It's so strong and so, and Stand By Me, it's so consistent that there is such a real sense of control of genre switching, of tone switch. Like, he can do it all, that the rest of his career, by necessity, kind of dims. It just... You never have a run like that. Nobody has a run like that. And I just think he demonstrated up front he could do everything well. Yeah. And he could do it in a way that was human, and in a way that... His movies are about connections. They're about real stuff. They, even something like When Harry Met Sally, that was dismissed kind of as a sitcom originally when it came out. You know, The Princess Bride was a disaster when it opened. We played that at my theater to empty theaters the entire time. It did not connect because they didn't know how to sell it. They didn't know how to tell people what it was. The trailers were not good. I remember the trailers, and the trailers were wildly unappealing. They just didn't figure out how to sell the tone of that thing.
Well, but it really is an incredible run, and it's like you say, anything that compares to that is going to pale somewhat in the shadow of it all. But it reminds me of what Joseph Heller said. He was interviewed by a journalist later in his life, and the journalist said, you never really wrote another book that was quite as powerful or impactful as Catch-22. And Heller took a moment and he said, yeah, that's true. Few have.
That's a flex.
Yeah, when the high is that high. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the chutzpah to come out with your debut as This Is Spinal Tap, which to this day, fucking hilarious. Holds up top to bottom.
And impeccable.
And invented a genre. I mean, that's, invented that's a genre. The thing. There's very few people that you can say, I mean, Romero is one, and Rob Reiner's another one, you know, that invented
and
the whole last
it,
fucking
no
genre.
Less.
Yeah. And hilarious in it. So,
yeah. Even the self-aware fairy tale you could credit to him. I mean, Goldman wrote the book, but remember Fractured Fairy Tales in the 90s and all that? I think his, Shrek. There's no Shrek if there's no Princess Bride.
No.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And The Princess Bride really is one of those movies that, kind of like Shawshank, like you can pull 10 people off the street, and I bet it's like the most important movie to three of those people. Like it is like one of those deeply important movies to so many
people. The Princess Bride is one that people who don't like movies like The Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Like it is that kind of a film. And yeah, his films left ripples through the community in all sorts of directions. I honestly don't think Lucas would have hired Bob Anderson to do the sword fights for the prequel trilogy if Rob Reiner had not brought him back to the business to do Princess Bride. Because Princess Bride became the thing that everybody who was doing sword fights looked at. And so you had
Wasn't Bob Anderson on Empire and Return of the Jedi?
Yep. Was he on those? Wow, okay. Then, yes, there is that through line. But I think, honestly, sword fights got...
Sorry, I didn't mean to...
No. But I think they got exponentially different in Princess Bride. And I think you look at the difference between the original trilogy sword fights and the prequel trilogy sword fights, and that did something to Anderson. That Princess Bride fight, which is still the greatest fight that will ever be on film with practical swords. Like,
we used to study that in stage combat, like all of the Princess Bride sword fighting, but particularly the big Montoya battle.
That scene is a
welding character and oh. Oh, amazing.
I'm not left-handed either. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to close things out, I have an uplifting story for us about, and it relates to The Princess Bride.
He's going to read Donald Trump's tweet about
it. Yeah, let's read Donald Trump's tweet.
From our great leader.
That movie is so beloved that people know it by heart. And I think because people know it by heart, you're able to spoof it and play with it in ways that you can't with other movies. And during the pandemic, Jason Reitman he got a bunch of actors together to shoot on their cell phones while they were all locked down in their homes, sort of a homemade do-it-yourself version of The Princess Bride. And he did it in like 10 to 15 minute chunks, and couples, like he had Tiffany Haddish and Common and Sophie Turner and Joe Jonas like playing Buttercup and Wesley for the scenes where you needed Buttercup and Wesley to be together. And, I think even, there's just a ton of different couples in the movie playing those parts, but every scene had different actors in it playing the roles. And then he stitched it together from the footage they shot of themselves. Neil Patrick Harris and David Burtka were another, Buttercup and Wesley. That's the name that I was thinking of. For the opening, he got Rob to play the grandfather.
Yeah.
And Josh Gad was the grandson. And I interviewed Rob about this because Rob obviously had to give a blessing to this whole project. And he thought it was fun. And he said, this is no way to experience the film. You have to know the film for this to be fun. So it was fine by him. It wasn't like people. I remember when I wrote about this at the time, people were like, why would they ever remake The Princess Bride? It's like, they're not remaking The Princess Bride. That's not what this is. Yeah. So, but it was, you know, you've got Rob playing the grandfather, which he had done on stage during one of those live reads of it. Mm-hmm. So he loved that because he was the grandfather, right? He was the storyteller. He was the guy entertaining everybody with these tales. But then in the next sequences, whenever the grandson and grandfather had to appear, it was played by different actors. But at the end, you know, it's such an important part to have the grandson be fully enthralled by the story. And then the grandfather leaves and the grandson says, could you maybe come back and read another story? And the grandfather says, as you wish, as he leaves, which is, of course, the code phrase for I love you. Mm-hmm. And then he departs. Such a moving moment. So Reitman got Rob Reiner to play the grandson in that scene. So he started the movie as the grandfather. At the end of the homemade Princess Bride, he's under the covers as the little boy. I mean, he's a grown man, right? In his 70s. But he's playing the grandson part. And Carl Reiner is playing the grandfather, who sitting there with a little storybook, closes it, puts on his fedora, and goes out the door and says, as you wish. Now, they shot it separately because they were not in the same home. And obviously, Carl was, I think he was 93 at the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe even a little older. Could he have been 98? But he was in his 90s. Yeah. So they were apart, but they had this moment where they shot this thing together. And Carl sends in his footage. 3 days later, Carl dies. And what Jason told me he waited a while actually to before reaching out to Rob and saying, listen, if you don't want this to be used, you tell me, but it is beautiful. Is it okay to move forward? And he goes, no, my dad shot it. That's his final screen appearance. It's us together. Yeah. It's him recreating lines from one of my best loved film. So it's, yeah, please go forward. So he
it's
did.
Also him and telling Rob, yeah, I love you. I mean, that's
it's him saying, I love you. Thing. Yeah. But it's also, he gets a little moment to say that to the camera and say it to the audience. And so Carl got probably the best exit you could hope for. He lived a long time and he got this final curtain call just days before he passed away. I wish Rob had the same. That's not what was in the cards for him, and it's awful and heartbreaking and sickening, but that doesn't mean that darkness has to taint everything else that he did. And I'd much rather think of him saying, as you wish, and departing than the way it actually happened. So we have at least that one, a real Hollywood goodbye, a real fairy tale ending with his father and a few years ago. So just a little something to think about. That's available, and you can find it on YouTube now. That whole thing is super fun to watch, but a tribute to Rob and his dad and the stories they both created.
Well, that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming in and talking through this. I know that this is all very raw still for anybody that knew and loved Rob's work and have been impacted by it, but I appreciate you guys coming in and talking about him.
Great to share stories with you guys. Thanks for joining us on the King.
Thank you for putting us together. To do this,
Many thanks to Nat Cassidy and Drew McQueenie for joining us for obviously not the most uplifting conversation, but you know, I think it was still good. It felt cathartic to talk about the man, the myth, the legend, Rob Reiner, his work, and what it means to us and means to us all. Thank you guys so much for listening. As usual, if you dig the show, make sure to head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. Throw us a few bucks. It is the best way to support the show. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Until the next one, adios, folks. The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.